America in 2023.
This show is nuts. And one of the things that I find really interesting about these shows is that they're so stupid and boring that it's hard to imagine who even would watch it. And listen, there are so many choices for things people can watch. I don't claim that my show is the most entertaining or informative or insightful. I don't claim any particular accolade for this show, but we've built an audience and the numbers are mostly public. I don't know who possibly would watch this John Jr. thing, but it's really hard to imagine him having a fan base of the sort that welcomes this sort of drivel. So that's what he's up to, seemingly hopped up out of his gourd. And what honestly is happening behind the scenes, I don't know. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. This voicemail caller, it's not so much what he says, but how he says it. One of the most interesting voices of any caller we've ever had. Listen to this.
Colonel Ranker with the Vets and Regulars of the United States of America. Watched your show with the pillow guy.
No.
Mike Lindell, another lying con man, made out of the same cloth as Donald Trump. You did a good job. You did a good job on this guy. You made him look like what he is.
Listen, I could listen to that guy all day. There's like a little bit of an Alex Jones element to it.
That man's a loser.
But it is even more sort of gruff and wild. But I love it. Maybe my new favorite caller. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. We'll talk about Joe Biden joining Truth Social to troll Trump. We will talk about the Mexican cartel saying, stop making fentanyl. It's bad for us when stuff gets laced with fentanyl. And the U.S. government has agreed to a settlement with some of the migrant families separated at the border. We'll tell you the scope and size of the settlement and the details. All of those stories and more are on today's bonus show, which you can find with pleasure. Republicans have failed to coalesce behind a choice for Speaker of the House, with Donald Trump's pick, Jim Jordan, not getting the support of the Republican conference, Steve Scalise getting the support of the Republican conference, and now raising the questions of where do Republicans go from here? Another loss for Donald Trump. Again, this incredible contrast where he controls the vast majority of the Republican primary, but seems increasingly to be ignored by actual Republicans in the House of Representatives. And then, of course, the practical question, when will there be a Speaker of the House? What can the House even do absent a Speaker? The answer is not very much. And so we will start with the first element of this report, Washington Post. Republicans fail to coalesce around Speaker choice, leaving House in limbo. Steve Scalise was nominated by a majority of the conference, but he did not have the support of 217 lawmakers needed to claim the gavel on the floor. So what happens now? House Republicans were on the verge of open revolt Wednesday after the ideologically fractious conference. That's an understatement. Ideologically fractious conference failed to coalesce around a speaker, leaving the chamber rudderless and leaderless for an eighth day. The inability of House Republicans to agree on who will lead them has left them in an effective standstill since Kevin McCarthy was ousted. Unable to consider any legislation to aid Israel in its war against Hamas, pass any appropriations bills to avoid a potential government shutdown in mid-November. Now, importantly, Majority Leader Steve Scalise was nominated for Speaker by a majority of Republicans during a closed-door secret ballot early Wednesday. But a significant number of Republicans from across the ideological spectrum said they planned to protest his official election on the floor. Jim Jordan, Scalise's challenger, initially refused to say he would back Scalise on the House floor. A spokesperson said Jordan would back Scalise and offered to give a nominating speech on his behalf. So Jim Jordan has some serious problems. And much like we've been talking about how becoming president may have been the worst business decision that Donald Trump ever made for himself and for his family, Jim Jordan's past, as Newsweek now writes, comes back to haunt him as Ohio State wrestlers speak out. Let me remind you what this is all about.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WWE.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What happened tonight is a huge tragedy and war massacre that cannot be tolerated or allowed to pass without accountability. Tonight, an Israeli airstrike hit Al-Ali Hospital in Gaza City.
Palestinian officials are accusing Israel of killing over 500 people in an airstrike on a hospital in Gaza City where thousands of civilians had sought refuge. Israel's denied responsibility as the overall death toll in Gaza tops 3,300. President Biden's in Tel Aviv for an unprecedented wartime visit to show U.S. support for Israel.
I want to say to the people of Israel, their courage, their commitment, their bravery is stunning. It's really stunning. I'm proud to be here. Thank you.
We'll speak to Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi, as well as Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Plus, we go to Israel to speak with a peace activist whose parents were killed in last week's surprise attack by Hamas that killed over 1,300 Israelis. The Sun is calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's in Israel hours after Palestinian officials accused Israel of killing at least 500 people at Gaza's Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in an airstrike. In addition to treating sick and wounded patients, the hospital was acting as a refuge for displaced Gazans fleeing Israel's unrelenting attacks. This is Mohammed Al-Naka, a doctor at Al-Ahli Hospital.
There was no warning before the hospital was targeted. There were about 3,000 people who were taking shelter here. While we were working at the hospital and without any warning, around 6:30 p.m., the hospital was targeted by shelling. We didn't know what it was, but we found out what it can do after it targeted children who were cut into pieces.
Gaza's health ministry said Israel told the hospital it had sent warning strikes one day before the deadly explosion. The UN has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. Amidst international condemnation over the attack, Israel's denied responsibility, blaming a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket. Israeli officials appear to have deleted a video posted on social media showing Palestinian rockets being fired after realizing the timestamp on the footage did not match up with the hospital attack. A planned trip to Jordan as part of President Biden's visit to the Middle East was canceled in the wake of the hospital bombing. Biden said he was outraged by the attack, which constitutes a war crime, but sided with Israel as he made remarks alongside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier today.
I was deeply saddened and outraged by the explosion at the hospital in Gaza yesterday. And based on what I've seen, it appears as though it was done by the other team, not you.
Many have pointed out that militant groups in Palestine do not have the firepower to level a massive building. Israel has a history of lying about its responsibility in crimes against Palestinian civilians, including the murder of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh last year, which it initially blamed on Palestinians. Israel apologized a year after her death. As Biden meets with Israeli officials, Palestinians condemned U.S. support for Israel's genocide. This is a resident of Khan Yunis in Gaza.
To President Biden and his administration, Generations will not forget, and history will be recorded, that it was your administration, your billions of dollars, your support with weapons of mass destruction to the Israeli Defense Forces, which has caused what is being happening right now in Gaza.
On Tuesday, Israeli strikes hit other civilian targets in Gaza, including a UN school where thousands were taking refuge. At least 24 UN installations have been hit in the past week, killing at least 14 UN staffers. Israeli forces have killed at least 3,300 Palestinians over the last 12 days. Around a third of those killed were children. Gazans continue to suffer from a lack of all basic necessities, including water. Turkey said it's in talks with Hamas to release hostages taken by the group in its deadly October 7th attack in Israel that killed over 1,300 Israelis. Meanwhile, Iran has warned of potential preemptive action against Israel as it prepares for a possible ground invasion of Gaza. Israel and Hezbollah, a Lebanese group backed by Iran, have been exchanging fire on the Israel-Lebanon border. Israel's reportedly set to ban Al Jazeera's operations in the country over its coverage of the war. Al Jazeera is one of the few global media networks that has reporters on the ground in Gaza. In related news, the Committee to Protect Journalists said at least 17 media workers have been killed since the start of the war, 13 of them Palestinian, 3 Israeli, and 1 Lebanese. Here in the United States, Jewish Voice for Peace and other groups are rallying in Washington, D.C. today to demand an immediate ceasefire. 24 rabbis are leading prayers and mass civil disobedience. Meanwhile, inside the White House and other government buildings, staffers have shared with reporters the challenges in calling out Israel's crimes against Palestinians. Government employees say they fear possible retaliation for even raising the issue of humanitarian protections or restraining Israel. 6 months of war in Sudan have plunged the country into one of the worst humanitarian nightmares in recent history, killing up to 9,000 people and displacing over 5 million. That was a stark warning issued by the United Nations, which said at least 25 million people in Sudan are also in need of urgent humanitarian relief. Humanitarian aid relief has been hindered by violence between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces since fighting broke out in April. The healthcare situation is also dire, as many medical facilities in conflict areas have been shuttered. Human rights groups have condemned the ongoing targeting and killing of civilians and journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists is demanding an investigation into the October 10th killing of Sudanese journalist Halima Idris Salim, who died after RSF fighters reportedly ran over her with a vehicle while she covered the conflict in the city of Omdurman. The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and opposition leaders have agreed to new rules ahead of next year's presidential election. The move is expected to clear the way for the United States to ease its harsh sanctions on Venezuela, which have wrecked the economy, forcing millions to flee. As part of the agreement, the Venezuelan government will allow all political parties to choose their candidates, grant permission to delegations from the UN and the European Union to observe elections, and give equal media access to all campaigns. In climate news, the Amazon River has dipped to its lowest levels in over a century amidst a protracted regional drought and wildfires. 60 of the 62 cities in Brazil's northern Amazonas state have declared a state of emergency as communities struggle to meet their basic needs.
It's challenging for the communities because what they don't produce, which is food, is what they need most at the moment, as well as medicines. We've just heard from people in the community about the fear of getting ill, the fear of needing medical care and finding it difficult to travel to the hospital.
In the UK, Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg was detained by London police Thursday at a protest outside the Energy Intelligence Forum, a major oil and gas industry conference.
Behind these closed doors at the oil and money conference, spineless politicians are making deals and compromises with lobbyists from destructive industries, the fossil fuel industry. People all over the world are suffering and dying from the consequences of the climate crisis caused by these industries who we allow to meet with our politicians and have privileged access to.
Back in the U.S., in Georgia, a man who was wrongfully imprisoned for 16 years for a crime he didn't commit was killed by police Monday. Leonard Allen Cure, a black man, was driving on a highway in Camden County near the Georgia-Florida state line when a sheriff's deputy pulled him over, reportedly for speeding. The officer notified him he'd be arrested before shocking him with a taser at least twice, beating him with a baton, then fatally shooting him. The 53-year-old man was released from a Florida prison in 2020 after he was exonerated for an armed robbery conviction from 2004. Since his release, he often gave inspirational talks to high school students and had plans to go to college. Far-right Ohio Congressmember Jim Jordan failed Tuesday to reach the 217-vote threshold needed to become the next House Speaker. 20 of his fellow Republicans voted against him, while 212 Democrats voted for House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Jim Jordan is a close Trump ally, was involved in efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. Congress members are again voting today. The House has been without a speaker for 2 weeks following the ouster of Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, a bipartisan move to empower Speaker pro tem Patrick McHenry to oversee legislative business is being discussed as a way out of the current quagmire. And the Supreme Court reinstated for a second time the Biden administration's regulations on ghost guns, unassembled, unmarked gun kits that can be purchased online. In 2022, the federal government imposed similar regulations on DIY guns to standard guns, including mandating serial numbers and background checks for purchasers. A federal judge in Texas issued a nationwide injunction on the Biden rule, but Tuesday's Supreme Court ruling will allow the regulations to stand while a legal challenge plays out. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials are accusing Israel of killing over 500 people in an airstrike on a hospital in Gaza City where thousands of civilians had sought refuge. Israel's denied responsibility, claiming the explosion was caused by a failed rocket fired by the militant group Islamic Jihad. Palestinian officials have blasted Israel's claim, pointing out Israeli military had already hit the hospital just days before. This is Dr. Fadel Naim, head of the orthopedic surgery department at El Ahli Hospital.
I will describe what I saw myself. I was in the surgery department, and I had just finished a surgery, and I was about to rest before my next surgery. Suddenly, we heard the sound of a huge explosion. In the beginning, we thought it was one of the explosions we hear all the time. We didn't think it was in the hospital. Then people came to the surgery department screaming and yelling, asking us to save them, telling us they were injured and dead people. It was a shock for everyone. The hospital was full of dead people, injured people, and body parts. People were crying and screaming. We tried to give first aid, but there were more injuries than we could handle with our limited resources at the hospital. Many people were martyred. Some of them were alive. We saw them alive and breathing, but we could not do anything for them. They died in our arms. We saw them.
The blast came just hours before President Biden landed in Israel for an unprecedented wartime visit to Israel, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to express U.S. support for Israel. Biden placed the blame for the hospital strike on Palestinians.
I was deeply saddened and outraged by the explosion at the hospital in Gaza yesterday. And based on what I've seen, it appears as though it was done by the other team, not you.
Biden said it appears it was done by the other team, not you. Earlier today, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza.
For an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to provide sufficient time and space to help realize my two appeals and to ease the epic human suffering we are witnessing. Too many lives and the fate of the entire region hang on the balance.
On Tuesday night, Democracy Now!'s Messiah Rhodes spoke with Dr. Haman Ola, an internal medicine and nephrology specialist working in Gaza City at the largest hospital, Al-Shifa, which is around 5 miles away from Al-Ahli Hospital, where over 500 Palestinians died in an airstrike. Dr. Alo said an earlier Israeli airstrike had hit Al-Ahli Hospital days before Tuesday's devastating blast.
This is a Baptist hospital, a Mike Levinoff, a Baptist hospital. This is definitely something not related to Islam or to whatever extremist group some people consider. So it is a very old hospital, aged more than 100 years. So it is situated in a very densely populated area. It was hit the day before, but patients, refugees, and staff couldn't simply leave the hospital.
So you're saying that the hospital was hit before?
Yeah, it was. And then when it was finally hit again, this toll is rising now to more than 800 lives lost. And what if this is going to happen in other hospitals, in bigger hospitals? The massacre is going to be worse. There will be no safer shelter for all patients. As a physician, I'm afraid if I now leave and go to work, my hospital is going to be hit as well. And we have, for example, in terms of dialysis, we have only now 5 hospitals providing hemodialysis service. What if nurses are afraid of going there? What if patients are afraid of going there? What if injured patients, war injured with war-related injuries, do not go there? This means not slow. This is even fast death, very rapid death.
Dr. Hamam Alo went on to describe how tens of thousands of civilians have sought refuge at the hospitals in Gaza.
In a Shifa hospital, there are almost 40,000 persons outside the hospital buildings. They came looking for safer shelter away from their high-risk areas. Those are in addition to the patients now living in the hospital hallways. Wherever you go, no matter what ward you go to, there are a lot of people sleeping, kids, women, ladies, elderly patients. Some of them are immunosuppressed. They are living in the hospital hallways. So you can barely even walk through the hallway because of people actually living there for more than a week. And you can't just simply ask them to leave so you can walk freely because they have no safer shelter, and many of those lost their homes now. So this is their new home. So if you could imagine the amount and the magnitude of transmissible diseases and infections, speaking of which, yesterday I met the first patient with a disease called leptospirosis. This is a bad disease that we usually get from poorly hygienic living circumstances, transmitted by rodents and sewage water and dirty drinking water. So this disease affects badly our kidneys and liver. The patient is in a state of acute renal failure, acute kidney injury. His whole life is threatened, and this is because he was in an UNRWA school as a shelter, but those schools are now very busy with very unlivable living circumstances. But he had to be there with his family looking for a safer shelter away from his threatened house.
That was Dr. Hamam Alo, an internal medicine and nephrology specialist working in Gaza City at Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest. When we come back, we speak to Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. Stay with us. Thank you. Music by Sana Musa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials are accusing Israel of killing over 500 people in an airstrike on a hospital in Gaza City where thousands of civilians had sought refuge. Israel's denying responsibility, claiming the explosion was caused by a failed rocket fired by the militant group Islamic Jihad. Palestinian officials have blasted Israel's claim, pointing out Israel, the military, had already hit the hospital just days before. As we continue to look at Israel's war on Gaza, we're joined by Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, a renowned Palestinian-American scholar. He's the author of a number of books, including his latest, The Hundred Years War on Palestine. Professor Khalidi's new piece for The New York Times is headlined, "The U.S. Should Think Twice About Israel's Plans for Gaza." We're going to go to that in just a minute, Rashid, what the U.S. should be thinking about right now. But if you can begin by responding to these developments of the last 24 hours with the explosion at Al-Ahli Hospital and the significance of this.
Well, it's obviously had an enormous significance. It led to the cancellation of a summit that was planned for Amman with President Biden. The Arab participants all pulled out after this atrocity. I think it's also led to increased anger all over the Arab world. There are demonstrations in at least 8 or 9 Arab capitals as a result of this. There was already rage at blanket American support for Israel, and I think this has increased that. I think that it is very hard to believe, given that Israel has threatened hospitals and schools in the past, and it's hit hospitals and schools in the past, and that the kinds of weapons used by Islamic Jihad and Hamas have very limited warheads, that this could have been, as the Israelis claim, a misfire. As you reported, a piece of video that they put up turns out to have been dated from a period after the attack on this hospital. In any case, whoever was responsible, the result will be enormous anger at the United States for its support of Israel, as well as a further increase in this enormous death toll inside Gaza.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, the Palestinian legislator and medical doctor himself, said they actually had, in a very short period of time, a number of explanations of what happened. At first, they didn't say this. They said that Hamas was operating underneath the hospital. Then they said they were using Palestinians as human shields, sort of to explain what had happened. Then they came up with this. Now, I wanted to ask you, we had on Sharif Abdelkaddous, who this award-winning documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akla, won the George Polk Award for that, documenting what Israel said about the murder of this Palestinian-American journalist. They first said she was killed by a Palestinian gunman, then said evidence was inconclusive. Then, after enormous pressure and multiple investigations by many news outlets and human rights groups, they said they likely killed her, but not intentional, and caught in crossfire, something that was disproven by human rights group after forensic architecture study of the whole thing. Showing it was an Israeli sniper, Professor Khalidi.
I mean, Israel has an enormously successful public relations machine. It took them, I think, 45 minutes to put out this specific cover story on this one, and it was immediately knocked down, as I think you've already reported, when it turned out that the piece of film that they produced actually dated 40 minutes after the attack on the hospital.
The New York Times pointed that out, the timestamp.
Precisely.
And then they actually retracted the video from X, from Twitter.
Precisely. I mean, they have a well-oiled machine to manufacture cover stories for everything they do. They have been warning hospitals that they are targets since just after this attack, the initial attack out of Gaza on the 7th of October. They hit this hospital the other day, as you just reported. They hit a school today. If you read the Israeli press, you have senior Israeli generals and retired generals talking about places like hospitals and schools as targets because they claim there are Hamas bunkers beneath them. So it's hard not to accept that this was an Israeli airstrike or an Israeli bombardment. In any case, I think here perception is reality. Given that Israel has dropped 6,000 bombs at least on the Gaza Strip in the last 11 days, it's very hard to believe that it will be very hard, at least for people in the Middle East, who know how Israel systematically lies about what it does in military operations, to believe that this was anybody else than Israel. And I think that's the important fact to retain. People in Palestine, people in the Arab world, people in everywhere except in the American, Western European media bubble are going to chalk this up to Israel's attack on Gaza.
So talk about your piece, the U.S. should think twice about Israel's plans for Gaza. Explain what you see unfolding now and respond to President Biden sitting down with the Prime Minister Netanyahu today and saying the other team did it, attacking the hospital, and go on from there.
Well, I mean, the president has bonded the United States to Israel at the hip since very soon after this horrible escalation started. And in so doing, he's made the United States responsible in the eyes of the world for everything. And this is the latest example of that. He's basically read from an Israeli teleprompter, as he seems to do routinely when anything relating to the Middle East comes up. It's almost as if his lines are scripted in Tel Aviv at the Israeli Defense Ministry, where their disinformation headquarters are located. And he has, I think, put the United States in a position that I am not entirely sure anybody in his administration realizes. The United States is going to be vilified, not just in the Middle East, as a result of its unlimited support for Israel. What we are seeing now is only the beginning. The munitions that are being sent, the aircraft carriers that have been sent to the Eastern Mediterranean, the huge bill that they're going to put before Congress for, I've seen a figure of $100 billion, is going to cement in people's minds the idea that the United States and Israel are one, which means that whatever happens in Gaza going forward in terms of people being killed, innocent civilians being killed, in terms of population being expelled, that basically we're talking about ethnic cleansing of northern Gaza, and heaven forbid people actually being forced out of Gaza into Egypt, which is still a possibility, even though the Egyptians have resisted. All of these things will be put down not just to Israel, but to the United States. And I don't think they fully realize, or if they do, they haven't done anything about it, that this is what the president has, this is where the president has put the United States. For whatever reason, electoral reasons, his own personal sympathy for Israel, it really doesn't matter. We are now in a situation where the United States, in my view, has put itself in a more precarious position in the Middle East than it has any time since the 1967 war.
Talk about what's happening on the northern border, on the Israel-Lebanon border, and Hezbollah, and the back-and-forth rocket fire that's going on there, and what this could signify.
Well, I mean, the most apocalyptic scenario, which I hope and pray does not come about, would be a full-scale war on the northern border between Hezbollah and Israel. That has the potential to draw many other actors in and turn into an even wider war than that, possibly, heaven forbid, involving Syria and Iran, and then indeed perhaps the United States. That would be a real apocalyptic scenario. I have a sense that the United States, Iran, and Hezbollah and Israel are all reluctant to go too far down that path. Any one of them might do something that could provoke that kind of escalation. But the real problem is unintended consequences of actions that are out of control. Whatever Israel, Hezbollah, or Iran and the United States may want, there may be actions that will precipitate a rapid escalation. And that would, I mean, the situation is appalling as it is. It really would be infinitely worse. The devastation of Lebanon that would follow, the involvement of communities in northern Israel would be devastated as well. But the possibility of that growing even wider is to me terrifying.
Talk about who Biden hears. I mean, on the one hand, you have Jordan canceling the summit. He was going to meet with the king, with the Egyptian president Sisi, and with Mahmoud Abbas, head of the Palestinian Authority, who turned around as soon as the bombing happened and said he wouldn't participate. Then Jordan canceled. Now the U.S. is saying they canceled it mutually. But what exactly this means? So the only image is President Biden hugging Israeli President Herzog and the Prime Minister Netanyahu at the airport when he arrived. But even at home, State Department officials afraid to raise the issue of Palestinian deaths. HuffPo had a very interesting piece on thin ice. Some Biden administration staffers feel stifled discussing the horrors in Gaza. And they talk about a call made by the head—let me see if I can find this— a call with Muslim staffers where they were told to talk about their concerns. And they talked about being afraid of being fired, of being blacklisted, if they dared raise the actual concern they have about what's happening and what the death toll could be and the position that President Biden is taking right now.
We are moving into a McCarthyite era where expression of sympathy for Palestinians is equated with terrorism and maybe met with police state tactics. Students are being visited by the FBI. I'm not in the least surprised that a government is sending the FBI to talk to student activists, is clamping down on its own employees who dare to express humanitarian sentiments. You are required now to utter a mantra in which you exclusively talk about Israeli suffering. And if you do not do that, you are branded and doxxed and so on and so forth. That's happening in the academic, in academia and universities. It's happening in companies. And it's, I am sure, happening within the federal government. I have no information about that. But that is in line with the administration's position, which is that this is a one-sided affair in which on the one side is absolute evil, something which, according to administration spokesman, is worse than ISIS, Daesh. And with that kind of Manichaean point of view, clearly anyone who expresses any dissent, you know, you are supporting absolute evil if you talk about anything but the unlimited suffering of Israelis. Now, the suffering of Israelis is unquestionable, but that should be the only obsession of the president and his men and women. Puts the United States in a position where maybe in the sound bubble of the United States, the so-called Western world, it's comfortable. But with the rest of the world, that will not wash, including countries that are not particularly supportive of Palestine, countries like India, China, and so forth. Those are countries that, and other parts of the world, I think, see things the very, very same way. So I don't know that these people understand the degree to which they're harming this country. By this kind of blind, one-sided Israel-first approach.
Let me ask you, Rashid Khalidi, if you were president, if you were President Biden, what would you do right now?
What would I do right now? I would immediately call for a ceasefire. I would make sure that the hostages were released immediately. It is unconscionable that they be held. That would require a negotiation between Israel and Hamas about what the terms for those that release would be. I would insist on that. It is absolutely urgent those people be gotten out. Most of those are innocent civilians, certainly the civilians amongst them, or many of them are innocent civilians. The second thing I would do would be to say to Israel, look, there is this Palestine question. It's been the problem for 75 years. If you don't address it, the United States will not be willing to offer unlimited support. And addressing it means talking about Palestinian self-determination, talking about ending the occupation, talking about rolling back settlements, not limiting the unlimited expansion of settlements. I mean, there's a whole set of things which, without which, you will never have a resolution of this. And so I would work towards a lasting resolution a struggle that's been going on, as I say in the book, for more than 100 years, instead of yet another Band-Aid, yet another attempt to stabilize a status quo, which is massively unfavorable to the Palestinians, and which will only lead to more suffering for everybody concerned. That is an idealistic position, perhaps, but I don't think that anybody who has any sense of how this is likely to develop would say anything different, frankly.
Rasheen Khalidi, we want to thank you for being with us. Edward Said, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including The 100 Years' War on Palestine. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed, The U.S. Should Think Twice About Israel's Plans for Gaza. Coming up, we speak with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories. Back in 30 seconds. This is To Mother You by Sinead O'Connor. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. He spoke earlier today.
Immediately before departing for Beijing, I made two urgent humanitarian appeals to Hamas for the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages, to Israel to immediately allow unrestricted access of humanitarian aid to respond to the most basic needs of the people of Gaza, the overwhelming majority of whom are women and children. They cannot justify the acts of terror against civilians committed by Hamas on October 7 that I immediately condemned. But those attacks cannot justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Each of my two humanitarian appeals have a value in themselves. They are not bargaining chips. They are simply the right things to do. And I am horrified by the hundreds of people killed at Al-Ahli Hospital this same day in Gaza by a strike that I strongly condemned earlier today. I call for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to provide sufficient time and space to help realize my two appeals and to ease the epic human suffering we are witnessing. Too many lives and the fate of the entire region hang on the balance.
We're joined right now by Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you respond to what's unfolding right now and to the UN's call for a humanitarian ceasefire at this point? After the deaths of some more than 1,300 Israelis and over 3,300 Palestinians.
Good morning, Hemi, and thank you for having me. What we are watching is a catastrophe of Olympian proportions. It's a humanitarian and political catastrophe. Since the very early hours of this new tragedy unfolding in the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel, I've unequivocally condemned what Hamas has done, its targeting of innocent civilians, its taking hostages. And at the same time, in the same breath, I have condemned the response that has been given by Israel under the pretense of under the pretext of self-defense and brutal, even unprecedented attacks in terms of intensity against a population which has suffered in the Gaza Strip alone five major wars over less than 15 years. So I've said how the killing of 3,000 civilians, the bombing of hospitals, schools, crowded markets, the leveling of houses, how can it ever be justified as self-defense? And amidst all this, I've said the only reasonable and necessary thing to ask for is an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, which of course must be also accompanied by the release of the civilian hostages that Hamas has taken. There is no way out without a peaceful solution, and it's important, it's imperative for the international community and the U.S., first and foremost, to take this opportunity to act even-handedly and with wisdom before we spiral further into abyss, because this is what's going to happen if the situation does not de-escalate.
Spiraling into an abyss. Francesca Albanese, if you could respond first to what happened on October 7th, the surprise Hamas attack that ultimately killed more than 1,300 Israelis. Now, we believe roughly 200 to 250, according to them, are additional people are being held hostage in Gaza. And then if you can respond to the plans of Israel, repeatedly what is said is they want to de-Hamasify Gaza and what that means.
What has happened since the 7th of October is, as I said, unconscionable, has taken everyone, even longtime observers of the situation in Israel-occupied Palestinian territory, by surprise. There is no way that what Hamas has done cannot be condemned as war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, with no prejudice to an investigation that needs to be conducted. And there is already an investigation ongoing by the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory and Israel. As I said, killing civilians and taking civilian hostages cannot be ever justified. Civilian life must be preserved at all times under all circumstances. And, you know, if we put this in context from a Palestinian perspective, the Palestinians have been under an oppressive regime, a settler colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory, which is apartheid by default for decades now. But so while resisting the occupation, resisting this oppression is a legitimate goal under international law, it doesn't give blanket license to kill or to target civilians. So resistance has rules as much as like the conduct of the occupied power, I mean Israel, has rules. And I cannot think of one rule of international humanitarian law that has not been violated. So this is clear. Now, going to Israel's response. Well, there is the opaqueness of declaring wanting Israel wants to uproot, eradicate Hamas from the Gaza Strip. We have to remember that the Gaza Strip has been under an unlawful blockade for 16 years, and it was already on the brink of humanitarian collapse, according to many sources, primarily the United Nations, other international organizations, even before the 7th of October. And what has happened is an intensification of this unlawfulness, because the blockade has been further tightened by declaring, by cutting off the Gaza Strip from receiving water, electricity, food, essential medicines, while it was also being bombed. I cannot imagine how this can, on Earth, be considered proportional. And again, all this violence, all this brutality unleashed against 2.2 million people, half of whom are children. How can it lead, on the one hand, to the eradication of Hamas, or to the, let's say, the de-escalation of the tension among the Palestinian people in Gaza? And there is another element here, which you rightly pointed to, which is the intent to move out, I mean, to eradicate Hamas, but also to move out Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. As I myself denounced, there is a risk of ethnic cleansing here, and it wouldn't be the first time. And there is both a declared intent, because there have been countless statements by Israeli leaders wanting to push the people of Gaza out into the Sinai. And there is also the practice, under the fog of war, mass displacement of Palestinians has occurred. In 1947-49, when 750,000 Palestinians were displaced, made refugees and never allowed to return. In 1967, when 350,000 Palestinians were displaced, made refugees, many of them anew for the second time, and never allowed to return. So what is happening now, it's targeting millions of Palestinians. So it would be the largest instance of ethnic cleansing in the history of this tormented land. And it's not possible that it happens under the watch of the international community.
So if you can talk about the rejection of the UN Security Council draft resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. The resolution was introduced Monday. It was introduced by Russia, won the support of Gabon, Mozambique, the United Arab Emirates, and China. Six countries abstained. France, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States voted against the ceasefire resolution.
Amy, it's not a coincidence that I started this interview by saying this is a catastrophe of humanitarian and political Olympian proportion. We can see the failure of the United Nations system to ensure peace and security now, because the fact that the UN Security Council has so far been unable to issue a strong condemnation of what's happening, of what has been committed by Hamas and what is being committed by Israel. This is, again, symptomatic of a decade-long political failure to resolve a situation that has been transformed into a humanitarian emergency, a humanitarian catastrophe, but it remains a political situation that needs to be resolved in line with international law. And it's upon the United Nations Security Council to do so. As I said, this is a critical time to show compassion and to show solidarity with both the Israelis and the Palestinians and act even-handedly.
I wanted to ask you about the news that Israel is set to ban Al Jazeera from reporting in the occupied territories after the attorney general approved the move. According to the Israeli media, the attorney general, Gali Baharav Meara, and communications minister Shlomo Karchi reached an agreement Tuesday on the wording of emergency regulations to stop Al Jazeera from operating. Francesca Albanese, what does this mean? I mean, here in the United States, and you're not always here, to say the least, but in this country, the news we are getting from the corporate media when it comes to the broadcast and cable networks, there is almost no one reporting regularly from inside Gaza. Al Jazeera does report on the ground in Gaza. The significance of this.
I have to say, I learned this now. I hadn't heard of it yet. It's extremely worrisome because, again, we need information. We need information so that, I mean, everyone, the public opinion and all the more political leaders. There have been very few independent voices reporting from Gaza, let alone after the 7th of October. But Al Jazeera has been an incredible source of information. So it's incredible that this is happening. At the same time, what I want to point to is that both Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations have done an incredible job over the years, and including these days, in these tragic hours, for both to report and also put in context what's happening. So I do hope that the decision to expel Al Jazeera will be repealed, and this
well,
will
it hasn't
even
been, it hasn't happened honest. Yet, but they're on the verge, it sounds like.
It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen, and this is all the more, it makes all the more necessary for the international community, individual member states, to prevent this from happening.
Well, Francesca Albanese, we want to thank you so much for being with us, United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show in Israel, where we're joined by Maoz Inon, who lost both his parents, Bilha and Yaakovi Inan, in the surprise attack by Hamas October 7th that killed over 1,300 people in Israel. Maoz is an Israeli peace activist with the movement Standing Together, who's calling for the war to end. His parents lived in a kibbutz, a farming collective just north of the Gaza border. They were 78 and 76 years old. Maoz, our deepest condolences on the loss of your parents.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about your parents and what you are calling for now? Because so often we're hearing the Israeli government use the killing, this mass killing of Israelis, over 1,300 killed, and it's not clear, but between 200 and 250 now held hostage in Gaza, as the rationale for a ground invasion and the bombing now of Gaza.
I'm overwhelmed with what happened to me and to my family and to my community and classmates, friends in our community, Israeli communities around Gaza. Nothing prepared me for this moment that I will be here speaking with you about my strategy. I wished I was speaking with you about the initiatives the peace and the shared society initiatives I've been taking part in the last 20 years. And I honestly, I'm overwhelmed with everything that's going on. My parents were loving people, an amazing couple, really adored and admired by their colleagues, their friends, their community, and of course by us, my five brothers and sisters, and their 11 grandchildren. They didn't want to harm anyone. They didn't want to fight with anyone. We have close and very tight relationship. We call it even a family relationship with the Bedouin in the Negev. I have many friends, colleagues, partner in Palestine, in Jordan, in Egypt. And what's happening now is just devastating. It's just devastating. And listening to you and your guest, I was crying again. I was crying again because of the term everyone are using. It's the other side team. It's kind of a blame game. Who started it? Who shoot the missile? How many victims there is from each side? And it's just, it's shocking. And we keep using everyone, including you and your guests, the same terms we are using for the last century, the century of this cycle of blood between Israelis and Palestinians. And my cry is to stop the cycle, to stop the cycle of blood, to stop the cycle of war. And I'm crying. I was interviewed a few days ago to the BBC, and I say there that I'm crying not for my parents, I'm crying for those who are going to lose their life in this war. And my cries didn't help for too many people, hundreds of people. And I'm crying now again with you, and I'm crying to everyone that's watching and listening. We need you to cry with us. Don't blame anyone. Me and my family, we seek no revenge. And we seek no revenge. We just seek peace. We seek for hope. You change the terminology we are using to positive terminology, for reconciliation, for recognition, for partnership, and for peace. I'm crying, and I'm begging you. Just wear the awareness, not to blame anyone, just to stop the war and to build a different future, to break this cycle of blood, to break this game of blood, and to build a new future with hope. And hope, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a spokesman, I'm not a politician, I'm a normal people. I'm working very hard for my living. I'm raising my three beautiful children. I'm married to a beautiful, beautiful and amazing woman. And I never thought something like this might happen to someone like me. You hear it maybe in Ukraine, you hear it in Africa, you hear it in else, like faraway places, and this catastrophe reached me.
Maos,
and it just, yeah.
There is
sorry,
a mass...
I'm very, very emotional. Sorry.
And again, my condolences to you, to your family. Today, there's a mass protest plan for Washington, D.C., led by groups like Jewish Voice for Peace. 2 dozen rabbis will be part of a civil disobedience, apparently. They are calling for an end to the occupation. Do you feel the same way?
I think occupation, of course, but we are in such a risk. And I think now calling for to do these things or the other, we are going back to the terminology. We are using the same terminology that it brought us to this situation. Let's call for peace. Let's call for hope. Let's call for a complete ceasefire. Let's call for building bridges. Of course, I'm against occupation. But it's irrelevant at the moment. There might, or I'm afraid, there will be many, many more victims. And what we all should be focusing now is to stop the war. Very simple message. And we must cry it. We must cry our message to everyone that has a heart that can listen.
Let me ask you, Maoz, there are people, Israeli families in front of the Israeli military headquarters in Tel Aviv, whose families have been taken hostage, either mother, father, daughter, son, and they are there saying the same thing. We often see them in the media describing the horror of what happened to their loved ones, but then the media doesn't go on to say what they're calling for. What do you demand right now of Prime Minister Netanyahu when you talk about ending the war?
Again, I'm calling and I'm crying, not to Benjamin Netanyahu, not to the leader of the Hamas, not to President Biden. I'm crying for humanity, for the entire humanity, for the entire mankind. I'm crying to stop the war. I'm crying for immediate ceasefire, and I'm crying for hope. Hope that will take us from this cycle of blood to a new and bright future. We must build hope. We must build a future, and this future must be based on equality, on partnership, on peace. And this is what I'm crying for. And it's not to blame this or the other, this person or the other. They are irrelevant anymore. We must build a new system.
We want to thank you, Maoz, so much as the show ends. And our condolences again, Israeli peace activists speaking to us from Binyamina, Israel. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
Remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milton, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve. Thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me.